So I like pickles. Anybody like pickles? I really like pickles. I love pickles. My son really likes pickles. It's like divided in half. My daughter does too. My wife is not so cute. So pickles, I really like pickles. And my daughter, who is very much into sort of organic things, said a couple years ago, well, Dad, the best way to make pickles is to make kimchi pickles. And so she's gotten me into making kimchi of all different kinds. She's given me a couple of great books and all sorts of things. In fact, recently I talked with her on the phone a couple weeks ago, and I was asking her for more information about some kimchi things. She said, Dad, I think I made a monster. Maybe. I love the tang of kimchi. I love the process because it's so easy. You just put everything in a jar and put a nice measure of salted water in it. You keep it under the water and it just naturally ferments and it gets nice and tangy. And you leave it out for about a week or something like that, and then you put it in the fridge and it gets cold and it's just great. Now you can't eat too much kimchi though. Lactobacteria has its own thing, so you just have to be a little careful with that. Well, to me, some of these gospels, maybe a lot of them, especially the parables, are a little bit like kimchi. They're tangy. Sorry, it's an analogy, but you might not find it as good, but I kind of liked it. So the sense that it's tangy, needs some digestion, you've got to work out a little bit, some preparation, it stays with you a little bit, and it keeps dwelling sometimes. And Jesus meant these parables to do this. He was a rabbi, and good rabbis were not just about instructing, they were about engagement and conversation. Engagement and conversation. So what do you think would be a Jesus in a conversational, I think, conversational teaching? Jesus would say, here's a story, now what do you think? What is this about? What do we do with this at this point? Kimchi. It's kind of tangy. Stays there. Case in point was last week when I was able to sit in a pew at the church where my wife and I can, where I can just be a parishioner. I don't wear my collar and I go and sit and I can listen to the sermon and the gospel as it happens. Last week was another sermon about wealth and some issues about it, resources. Was a story about the unjust steward, if I remember rightly. And at the end of the very end of the service, one of the parishioners came down the aisle. I ended up meeting her because she wanted to talk with me. She said, Dave. Now, I was not a preacher. I did not participate in the service. But she said to me, sounds to me like the Bible is all against wealthy people. It's all against people with wealth. And that's kind of the message you could get from that. That could be one of those responses. Am I a bad person? Is this all against me? And I was sitting on my feet and I just responded and I said, no, it's really not about wealthy people. It's not against wealthy people, meaning the New Testament of Jesus. But it is about how wealth that works on us and how we use our wealth and also the systems that help us make more wealth. Well, that's as far as we got. It was my little quick thing at the spot. I know she was handing over to Mother Anita to go talk with her too about this as well, because Mother Anita is the priest in charge down there at St. Anne's at Old Vine, where we are. And yeah, enough there. But that's the kind of thing these parables do. They get us to be uncomfortable, kind of sit there and, what's this about? How does this have to do with me, with us. Well, my response and my later thinking about that and how it dovetails in with what we've got today, in a sense, so reminded me of what Timothy said, a sentence I never really liked, but I know it's often true, as money is the root of all evil. Ouch. Money is the root of all evil. Ow, what do we do with it then? We need money.
We like
to have it. We like resources. We need it. Our young people in particular live in this climate, this time, financial time, in which they need resources and they're hard to get. How do we do with all of that? But that is part of what's in this gospel too, the sense that it's us, our human relationship with our resources, that's often where the dark magic is. It's often where the struggle and the challenge is. What relationship do we have with our resources is often the challenge. And there are probably three things that go on in our gospel that are related to that. And what's going to happen with what the rich man's life is like before even he gets to the latter half of our parable. What are those things that happen? Well, part of it is the walls that get set up. Our relationship with our wealth is sometimes that they end up setting up walls around us, gaps and spaces. So there's the rich man living in his space, and it's like some kind of a gated community of a kind, and there's a gate outside at least, and Lazarus is outside there, somewhere apart from and distant from. So having resources sometimes sets that up for us in ways that maybe we should sort of be thinking twice about them. There's another way too, and that is this blindness that we see in the rich man. He never sees this Lazarus person. Does not know his name until later when he says, "Oh, send Lazarus." Doesn't the blindness. So there's this way we don't see. I grew up in Long Island and I didn't realize until just a few years ago that where I lived and grew up in the middle of the island, not a particularly wealthy area, sort of very middle class, right near Levittown, North Massapequa, not even Massapequa, North Massapequa. And right in that area, I found out it was redlined. I had no idea until fairly recently, but it made sense. Total, complete sense. And I realized how I grew up and who I knew and who was in my neighborhood. Gates, spaces, blindness are there. There it is in the rich man's story too. He never sees Lazarus. And then a lot of it's unintentional, especially if you grew up in it in a sense. I never intended for this to be true. I'm not even sure my parents knew quite what was going on with all that. They just wanted a house in 1952, and that's where the houses were. And so they said, "Well, we can afford that. We'll go there." They went. That's where I grew up. So, and then there's this final thing, at least I'm going to explore today, and that's this thing about the arrogance piece that gets going. And that's also unintentional. So there's the rich man, and it's in that later part of the parable. The rich man is standing there and says to Abraham, "Well, send that guy. Send Lazarus to help us." As though Lazarus is his servant. Intentional? We need a messenger. We'll send him. So that assumption, there's some kind of assumptive thing that the rich man does as well. And he only knows Lazarus' name after they're both dead. So they're not intentional. We don't mean to have that kind of an attitude or that kind of a viewpoint, but then it just kind of gets in there. Gets into us. Some of us have been exploring this in many different ways. We've been exploring it, and probably many of you are ahead of me in your reading and your lookout at an awareness of some of these issues that have been in our communities for so long. I mean, the books like The 1619 Project and Complicity. You've seen the movie Traces of the Trade. This is in terms of racism. You were blind, deaf. There are all these walls, we never saw them. Maybe we did. Some of us did. Didn't see them very clearly, still don't. And we're still sort of learning about where those are and maybe how to respond to them. How do you respond to that? Well, certainly awareness is one of the ways. One of the ways we start being sort of aware of our own richness. Even when we don't know ourselves or feel ourselves to be so. We know the stats. We're still at the top. We could be middle class in this country, still be at the top couple percentage points when it comes to the world and the world's population and resources. So we sort of getting some of those blinders off and some of that rethinking is certainly part of that. But there's more, and we're going to be actually about to do this baptism, and there's a lot in the baptism service itself that is beautiful in terms of like restarting our brains and restarting our kind of spiritual life again, and which is something, almost you have to do every day. You start again, and you start again, and you start again. Paul talked about it even more in depth. He would talk about dying daily, that you have to just let all the baggage go, or come back into life with a small L and a capital L. There's a lot of that actually in the baptism. These wonderful, pay attention to those denunciations and affirmations, and then how you live them out. Out of all the things that we do to live out the creed, we live out those things. But there is at the heart of baptism this other thing, and that is this washing. This is sort of my last point. You're talking about responding. How do we respond and learn how to be wealthy people in a new way? Right? The heart of baptism is what we often see is washing. We take this water and Ashley will hold Henry and we'll just do a little washing. But it's not just a washing. It's actually a reminder of Jesus' death and resurrection. So water is also a symbol of dying and rising. So as we participate, Henry is dying to all of that other way of thinking that is blinding and is deafening and the things that sort of hold us back from the capital L life. And we're reborn, we actually celebrate his rebirth as someone who is now into real life and into rethinking. And right after that, soon after that, I'll take a look at the leaflet. I'm going to do a little water for all of us as we remember our baptism. But what I want you to remember is this thing, this rebirth thing. That every time we do this, maybe it's in a certain day, we remember our baptism. And that we're made new in this new life, so that we can respond in new and healthful ways with all that we have. Amen. Service continues with our baptism, and Paul, Ashley, and I realize that there they are. That's great.